November 69. This is beginning of Channel 2 over. Beginning of Channel 2 over. Late Sunday afternoon. Sunday, the 60th, November 69, with Barbara, Suzanne, Faye, and me.
Don't let it sound that way.
Last spring, when the weather was so pretty, and Jim had been out on a field trip, and so he'd seen this field that had a bunch of horses in it. We didn't have anything to do that night but a movie we'd already seen. We didn't want to see that. So we just went driving. And we got lost because we were going, he wasn't sure exactly where it was, but he knew sort of. So we went the opposite direction. We finally ended up near the field. Anyway, so we stopped, and we picked the grass along the side of the road so the horses would come up, and we were picking out which one we liked best. There's one that's kind of that speckled blue color.
Mm-hmm.
I think they call it blue roan,
yeah.
But it was pretty. And then there's one with the colt, and actually we tried to get that one up. And when the lady who owned them finally showed up, she came out to feed the mare and the colt, and then she took them across the field to another, she had some more horses across the road. So we were talking to her, and she wasn't too friendly, but she said she owned them all, and she said that, I said, well, what do you use them for? And she said, well, she just saved them for her grandchildren. The lane doesn't like cars passing. I found out the first time because I wasn't ready for her. She went, well, she slid out, felt like she's, her back end moved and her front end didn't. See, I was sitting in the middle, it didn't work too good.
Cold.
So we went on the next time I was ready for her.
Now, Suzanne, here's the question that came up last time.
It's getting hot.
Well, please don't get into it.
You stay hot, we're about out of gas. Now, here's the question, you know. Now, how does Margaret Mead appear to you now?
Oh.
About 3 months later? How long?
About two and a half.
Two and a half.
As far as I can tell, so far she hadn't applied. Mm-hmm. Because the amount of work I do around the house doesn't cut into time. But it's myself that uses up the time that, you know, that I could be spending someplace else or doing something. And I waste it doing, well, stupid things. And so far, the only thing I particularly hate about housekeeping is making sandwiches the night before, which I detest. But other than getting tired of cooking every once in a while, it hadn't done anything. Because this whole summer I wasn't married, and I didn't have anything to do but go to work and come home at 6:30, and I had the whole rest of the evening, and I did nothing the whole summer except read Ship of Fools. And
what's bad about the Ship of Fools?
Oh, well, she dragged it on too long, for one thing.
Well, now, let me see. As I remember, these weekends are a little different from the other ones.
No. They're different in a way, but when I was in the dorm, weekends I usually wouldn't count on getting any homework done because I had too much time. I would spend, well, Friday night I didn't do anything. That was just long habit. Friday night, school's out for the week, and that's it. But Saturdays, I'd usually just piddle around, and invariably I'd end up going down to the bookstore and buying a magazine or a paperback or something like that. And like one time I read The Miracle of Language, that book you talked about, and I read that all afternoon instead of doing a paper. So, and then I'd go out Saturday night, and then Sunday, that's when I get homework done, in the morning, and at night, about 9 o'clock. And now it's not much different, except that I do more homework sometimes, like on Friday night, because we stay home. Well, and then I usually watch TV. And Saturday I do homework, because I'm not doing the laundry. And Saturday evening, we do homework. Let's go to a movie. And Sunday, I just set Sundays aside, mostly. I don't do anything on Sunday till the evening.
Well, you think you're just vegetating now?
Yeah. God, I have been. This summer I sure did. That's terrible. I had all sorts of plans. I was going to read a lot of things I hadn't read and didn't do it. Except, let's see, I read Huckleberry Finn and part of The Ambassadors. And that was a struggle, what I did read of it. So I didn't read much of that. And Ship of Fools. And then a few things I'd read before.
But now these musical weekends you have now.
Musical. That. Oh, well, that's kind of funny because about, I guess, 6 o'clock, they have this show called the Stan Hitchcock, which is the worst country music show I've ever seen.
Get
over here. Out of your way. Hey, this is unfair.
Well, the rest of us have a chance. This is what you have to pay for riding, this
is. I guess so. We just watch that once. Usually, it's when we're at home at Jim's house at the paper. that the country music shows are on. And then they watch Porter Wagoner and I forgot the name of the other one, but it used to be two guys who had a show, and then one of them left, and he wears this big fancy, kind of like Liberace jacket, with all the sequins, and it's a cowboy jacket. And so they have those shows on, and those are funny because it's not only the music, but it's supposed to be kind of a all we country folks getting together type thing, against the world sort of. That's the impression I get. Because it seems like they have a special way of talking and all, and they like bang and I think this and that, and they cultivate this, and they're always making remarks about hippies and classical things, you know. So they downgrade anything that's not country, and make themselves, you know, like we're a small group, but we really like each other, and. One thing I noticed, that they don't have but maybe one or two Negro performers, which is kind of unusual now, in singing anyway. And Jim said that the reason this was because of the type of class that people that listen to it, and they would be the kind that wouldn't be too happy about having Negroes on the set too often. And they make snide remarks, but it's all, you know, it's all supposed to be real happy, and they call each other buddy and pal and everything like that. And the music's okay once in a while. Sometimes they have some good songs, but I just, listening to them, I can listen to the music, but I can't watch the shows. It just, it's kind of,
Shows like,
Well, they come out and they start out real fast with the banjo and the guitar and the fiddle all going real fast. And they say, we got a fine show for y'all tonight, folks. We have Little Jimmy somebody and this girl and that group. And then they introduce this, you know, their guests. They come out and they tell a few jokes to each other and compliment each other. And then they go on with the song. And It's just, it's a real informal type of show. But to me, it strikes me as just kind of put on. But it may be because I'm not familiar with that.
Well, the show is just musical numbers, one song after another.
Yeah, well, no. Because they have maybe, I guess maybe 5 songs in a half hour. And the rest of the time, they're talking to each other. Or, well, of course, advertisements, which are usually for farm implements and logging things, you know, like sauce or dog food. And but it's about divided between talking to each other and songs. At least what I've seen of it. Every week, Saturday. I can't remember the name of it, though.
Yeah. Now, that's what you see when you go home.
Yeah.
To the Cape.
That's what they have on Saturdays, yeah. He turns it on. His father does.
Yeah. Well, now, how does his father, what's his connection with all that music?
He likes it. He was born in Kentucky, I think. And they were farm people, I guess. You know, that just that's how they made their living. And he was the youngest of 10 brothers. And it's just he enjoys it. He really likes it. And he turns it on, and he plays it mostly weekends. Well, of course, that's when I'm there. And he turns it on Saturday morning and plays it and plays it and plays it, you know. And Sunday morning, and then he watches. He makes sure he sees the show in the afternoons. But and then he runs off tapes for Jim, so Jim can have some too.
And take it home with him?
Yeah, bring it back up here.
Yeah.
See, he's got a lot of records, so he tapes off. He plays the record and tapes it, and then gives the tape to Jim. So now we have we've got 3 of them, I guess.
So now you can play it through the week.
Yeah, we don't. I'd rather not. Well, not that often. When he first gets a tape, he'll play it maybe 5 or 6 times. And then it sits there a long time, and every once in a while I play it again.
Oh.
But the tape he's got is, it doesn't have all that talking between the performers. It's just songs. And some of them they're kind of fun to listen to. I'm starting to, I like it now. Some of them, I've heard it so much, you know, I can start telling which ones I like and which ones I don't.
You're beginning to like it a little bit now.
Yeah.
You and Mark and me.
But I don't know. I think it's not really any worse than rock and roll. It's certainly not worse. But I mean, like, I can only listen to about 5 songs, and that's it, as far as I'm concerned.
What's your sister's?
My American poetry class, we have to do a lot of outside reading. And about half of the books we read are on this the New World type idea, you know, the optimism and the West, and dealing with Emerson and Thoreau and all. And they really put it in, you know, real nice terms, regular critical articles and all. But it kind of helped in a way, reading it that way, as well as like we discussed it in class. But it comes more across, I guess, the books wouldn't, if I had read the books first, I wouldn't have gotten much out of it. Because they, just the terms they use, I guess if I'd studied it long enough, but having had your class first and then reading the books, it makes books easier.
Well, does that develop into the music you hear on the weekend too?
The music, I don't pay much attention to it. The people, and it seems like they're people that are trying to keep themselves as they used to be. Instead of being caught up in what's going on or what's changing, you know, it keeps changing, the world and all, and this American society, they're trying to stay back the way they were, say, 50 years when they were still farming and all. And a lot of the people who listen to it aren't farmers, but they're from a farming family. But they're trying to keep back the way they were and not change. And they just keep the same songs and the same type of songs. Yeah.
Well, I think you would find more favorable ways of singing.
Probably. It's just...
You can they can take just so much reality, and they have to create their own.
Maybe, or maybe that is. To them, maybe it is still a reality. And I mean, it's just, yeah. But, I mean, they haven't changed, maybe. And so they're not trying to keep things the way they were. They're just still there. But, like some of them, I just don't know, because I haven't, it just, since I've been going, staying at Jim's house, that I really paid any attention to it. Because our family, I mean, we just, it's hillbilly music. So,
to your family.
Yeah, it's hillbilly. And as such, it's not worth paying attention to. In fact, turn it off the radio before we listen about two notes. You know, once you find out that's hillbilly, flick, radio goes off. But for them, it's very good music. And probably when they heard classical music, they'd turn it.
I think you're straddling. That's not reality. That's just a weekend reality. Just what they want to think about. But I guess the real world is during the week.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep that old 19th century.
Right.
That's
where every man would be on his own and could make
his
own way.
That's a feeling of a new world. That's it. Could you develop that a little as a new world?
Well, I'd have to mix in my history course that I just had. Because that's kind of helped, too, understanding what happened. Or what maybe, what happened. Because we started with 1900, or the Gilded Age, just before. When the agricultural... Where America was changing from agriculture, mainly, to industrial, and people who were still in agriculture couldn't understand why they weren't as important as they'd always believed they were. And they'd become less and less important, I think. And so they lost what they'd always believed in. As this book I used called it, I think, Jeffersonian Democracy, where the individual man is worthy in himself and is quite capable of guiding his own life and his own government. And during the late 1800s and into the 1900s, it wasn't happening that way anymore. And so it just seemed to me there was a great deal of disillusionment. So I don't know exactly how you tie it in with country music.
All the good old time people, your neighbors, were pork chumpers. That's the way they call it up here in North Florida, North Central Florida, and the Panhandle in particular. They were pork chumpers. That's the old time people who didn't come from Miami and Tampa, you see, the metropolitan area. Now they.
Folks.
Yes. So the. Yes. Your good old hillbilly people are pork chumpers. And their Scotch in history.
They were being assaulted, I guess they thought they were, from the big interest, the city people. Like, we had this book on William Jennings Bryan, and the idea that it was the East and the money interests that were taking away man's, the individual man's right to govern himself. To lead his own life. And so they fought against it. And I think that still is going on with people fuss about the government taking over and only being a number and all that. And it just comes out in different ways.
Well, now all that is a part of those country music weekends.
Yeah.
Saturday morning and Sunday morning. And then the plays in the afternoon.
Because his father works at the air base.
Yeah.
He's a foreman of maintenance and all. And, discussions at the dinner table and all, it gets on to what the government's doing and taxes and stuff like that.
And none of the information is straight.
No, most of it, no.
No.
I mean, at least not to my ideas.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh. But I consider myself more enlightened than them in a way, because I guess probably just because I do. Most people think they're right, but Jim and I won't bring up an argument about a lot of things because we know that there's no way of convincing them that we're right, and it just upset them. So, you know. But just.
I think your best point is that you see the country music now is the hillbillies now are the pork choppers, and all of that is a part of the country music on the weekend. Now that is a fairly mental view of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't had a mental view all summer.
There's two margins of that.
And you did a little inquiry.
Well, it's, you know, you can think about things and all, but unless you have me, unless I'm made to come out and say it, it just kind of all stays jumbled up.
Yes.
That's why they ought to be taught.
That's where Margaret Mead comes in. She's got you. She's got you.
Well,
the inquiry.
The Emersonian inquiry increases the faculties.
Yeah, sharpens the...
sharpens the perception.
Perception. That was their assumption.
Yes.
You don't think so?
Yes, I think so.
Well, how would that apply to Suzanne? As you've heard this discussion.
Come on, let's play the game.
Can't even listen around here anymore.
She said it.
Said what?
She said that she could see things and look at things, but until she was forced to, she would never bring them together.
Well, that's a rather awkward way of saying it.
Kick you. I will.
Now she's going to kick. You better be careful.
I'll state it right clearly for her.
All right. Through the inquiry, she's able to see into what she's experienced at home and come in contact with in her courses and draw some sort of, well, not a conclusion, but at least see a direction in it.
Well, do you think she's seen much direction?
A little bit.
Do you think she's seen?
Well, she's sort of seen that this hillbilly music and the people who sit around and watch it on a weekend aren't necessarily just hiding in the past. That they are.
Well, let's have it now.
But the past is still part of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an ambiguous phrase of putting it.
Well, it's real for them.
You gonna rest the case on one word?
What is reality? I'll get that in my philosophy course next quarter.
You don't need your philosophy course. You've already got it. I think that's the point. You see, everything's really what the direction seems to me Suzanne goes in, like everyone else it does and is forced to. It's just an exercise of patience. Like Thoreau said, he didn't want to practice resignation if he didn't have to. but that's what most people practice.
But it occurs to me that the difference is, with using a little inquiry, Suzanne could see what she has just expressed. And that would make it a mental thing, and not just practicing resignation.
What were one or two of those innocent pieces of information you explained to me as we came back from Louise Graham's last Sunday?
Interesting. There's the main thing, I think, was that there's different types of country music, you know, very specific types. There's the slow, real drawled out, where you slur up the scale to say one word or something. And then there's the real fast kind, loud and fast mainly. The other one's loud and slow, but the other one's loud and fast. And usually, the main singers, the most well-known ones, each have a very particular style, and some of them are stupid. I mean, like one will sing at a real high falsetto, and I forgot what his name was, but he'll jump from a real, real low baritone into a falsetto, and he sings his whole songs like that. And it's just that different people like different styles, and they've usually got a singer to match better style. Mm-hmm. And they have the love songs. Usually the woman leaves the man. I think that's how it goes in popular music too. And then they have the religious kind, which, I'll meet you at the church, or we'll sing at the river. They call them the good old gospel sings. Mm-hmm. And that's how they usually term good old something, or good old this, good old that. But that's about the main thing. The different styles are very
well marked. That's right. Nice. Last spring, you never. I guess you knew at the time, but you didn't know. You were going in the direction of a large footnote on that fine article. Who that was?
M-A-L-L-E. Yes. He used the term Emersonian vision.
Yeah.
Dimmesdale had.
Yeah.
And which I was when I read it, I thought, I wondered why you hadn't given it to the rest of the class to read. You didn't give this.
Yeah. Well, it was that idea of the new world. You see, it's sort of a relic in a museum piece in the Hillbilly Music. I think that's a part of Whitman's world that he saw. But you see, he thought he could speak to those people. But he'd have to do that electric guitar before he could do it, wouldn't
he?
Huh?
Yeah.
Now that's a considerable blunder.
What do you think about those four tapes over there? Four reels.
I don't want to have to play one of your old tapes, Bob. Say something coherent.
Is it? Yeah. But, heck, I'm reactionary.
What would you say then?
Just can't see in front of this mic and talk like this.
She can tell experience in front of it.
Thoreau and Whitman all talk about the New World, but I wonder if it ever really was there. I mean, for them it was. At least they thought it was, but I just kind of wonder if there ever really was that New World. To me, it seems like about the time they were figuring it out, they're realizing it was gone with the Civil War, and then after that, it just never had a chance to develop. That's just, I didn't read some more on it, but I mean, to me, it just seems like it never was really quite there and with them.
I think it's very definitely there. You've got the monuments of it, you see, and Ishmael, and Song of the Open Road, and Huck, Jackson Island. It comes to life.
Mark Twain.
I guess maybe the reason that to me it seems like maybe it never was is because it's still hard for me to think in those terms, kind of. I guess that, well, it's hard to explain exactly, but to me, Melville's poetry are some of his ideas, not just other than Ishmael. Seems like he goes against the optimism or the new world idea. I mean, like, he doesn't see it. And maybe that just, his point of view is more in tune with the modern point of view, because I think today it is gone. That it just, maybe individuals can find a new world, but as a society it's gone. I mean, it's not even... doesn't seem like it's a very real part of it, and that's why it's hard to for me to see it. I mean, I can see it in Huck Finn and Ishmael and all, but it doesn't seem real too much.
How does that work with Miss Tilk?
That's good.
Mm-hmm. It was definitely real, and she definitely lived in that kind of world. Mrs. Tilt was in England. She was in writing school, and she had to live in the modern world, handle herself in the modern world. She used to talk about her childhood, and didn't, you could see glimpses of her, but the way she talked about Stratford, you see, and what happened in Stratford, and things like the pride and the everybody took in the last coach that was in Stratford, and everybody used to go to the doors to watch it go past, and team of horses and the driver. Everybody knew the driver by name. That was a real world for her. And she knew it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
But
maybe if I had contact.
She had to see, be wrapped up in keeping the accounts and cooking for anywhere from 12 to 22 people, and she didn't have time to do things for the church like she wanted to, and she didn't have time to live like she had lived, but she'd talk about the Christmases when she was a child, and all the family would be there and gathered around at Christmas, and the old home. So they used to have a big house in Stratford, and her father was the mayor of Stratford. And the one thing that she would manage to find time to do would be to go to at least a few performances of the plays in Stratford, because her father had been on the president of the board and had that theater built, been influential in having it built. And it was her place, it was still her place in the community to go to some of those performances.
But not many?
But not many. One or two a season. And once to the opera, and once to the ballet. And she had seen all those plays so many times, and she could remember, if she'd have some of her friends over, very, very rarely, but occasionally she would have people over. And they would sit, there was one especially, used to sit and talk about all the old performances at Stratford and who she had seen there. And it was like, and she would talk about these really famous actors that I had no idea who they were. You know, and she was, but of course you know who that is. Yes, of course, you know, like, oh yes, I know who that was, and she would give a tremendous description. This wasn't Mrs. Tilt, this was one of her friends, but she could remember the performances in detail, and how excited the audience got.
She really didn't need to go to new performances, she could recapture the old ones.
This one, yes, this little friend, this wasn't Mrs. Tilt, this was a friend of Mrs. Tilt. And she loved to chat. She just talked forever about her experiences. And she was from Mrs. Tilt's world.
And that world exists in Barbara's mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because she had a glimpse of it through Mrs. Tilt. So the world lived.
And she's perceptive enough to see it.
And it still lives, you see, in your mind. It's protection now, you see, against too much reality. Reality is over inside. Oh, there's too much reality in the world. It's not really
it's
real.
Frightening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just frightening. This is the end of that beautiful little tape with Suzanne and Barbara. I've gone clear through it, step by step, point by point. Oh, it is amazing. It's just revealing. And this is Channel 2 over 4:30. Channel 2 over 4:30. Late Sunday afternoon, the 16th of November, 69, with Suzanne, Barbara, Faye, and me. Channel 2 over 4:35 now. Late Sunday afternoon, 16th of November, 69.
I don't even know. Okay. It's Monday the 17th of November at breakfast. Monday the 17th of November at breakfast. It's Monday morning, 17th of November. It's after breakfast. A cold spell's over. It's around 4:40. Channel 2 over 4:40. Well, I just can't wait till I get through college.
Why, Barbara?
Well, I want to get my dog. I want to get an Irish Wolfhound. You can't do that being in college.
I don't even know what one's like.
Well, they great look like great big, overgrown, thin Airedales. About the closest you can get. They're the tallest dog they're supposed to be. And, well, I saw a pair of them at badminton horse trials. And there were these eyes walking along. And I happened to look around. And it was two great big dogs. And in between them, there was this little boy about as tall as the dogs were. And he was just wandering around, jump to jump, leading these two dogs. And the dogs would follow right along with him. And when he'd stop to look at something, they'd just sit themselves down and pant and grin at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't resist it. I had to go talk to him. Because it was the first time I'd seen Irish Wolfhounds real, you know. So I went up to say hello, and they were real glad to say hello. They didn't fawn, didn't ask, but they were right glad to chat and talk. And they looked like they could have really, really loved to go on off for a good romp in that big badminton park. But the little boy went on, and they walked around right beside him and never pulled at him or did anything. They could have just dragged him off. They never decided to go anyplace. He's been there. Nice.
Are they good for anything?
Well, they used to be good. I don't know. They used to be good at stag hunting and wolf hunting. I don't know. I came across an article. I've read up on them a bit, you know, here and there. And I came across an article in Sports Illustrated one time that had as its title something about Irish wolfhounds and Irish legend. And I never got to read it. And I have been intrigued ever since with what that article might have said about Irish wolfhounds. It was one of the great mysteries.
But they'd go way back.
Way back, yeah. Well, the little bits of information I've got, they're supposed to have always been Irish wolfhounds in Ireland. You know.
Well, it's not fair to bring up the housekeeping when you talk about the pets as you want.
Well, I don't know. I've given it thought here and there, because I really want one. But I know people in England who have boxers. And, I always thought they had to be fed houses of meat. And they said, I don't feed theirs much, and their dogs look awful healthy. And they said, no, we never have fed them much, and they just never learned to like much. So they're happy.
Mm-hmm.
And they get along. And I've always heard that wolfhounds were tough. So maybe I won't. Eating out of the house, no.
Well, I've seen these animals out here. Easy feeders, you know. Some horses, big, but they don't eat much.
Yeah.
And Dinkle, you know, is always just bale hair weak. Keep Dinkle going.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty.
Yeah, sleeping
around. Yeah. Most people out here would have a lot of pets. But I find I can practically keep a herd of cattle for the attention it would take for one dog.
Yeah, I suppose it's true. I don't know, you get so used to having a dog around, you just can't not have one.
Little girl I'd write letters. Christmas letter was always that I wanted a wirehead terrier. And I never got one. I just got bird dogs. But I wanted something I could bring in the house and love and sleep with me. But my parents knew that a wire haired was not a good child's pet.
Yeah, I suppose what you wanted was a court jester.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they are. They love to entertain you. Our dog was, I named him Tristan, because I got him the same day my other dog died, and I figured Child of Sorrow was about as good a name as any. I didn't realize what it was going to do. I'm convinced of the power of names now, but when he died, the only thing I could think of, and the reason we had to have him put to sleep, and I just think of that scene in the when Tristan is playing the court jester in front of Mark and Isolde, and really half mad. And that was Tristy. But he loved to entertain. He would entertain you all day and all night too if you would pay that much attention to him. He was the only dog I've ever had that learned to catch and fetch and really play ball with you. All my other dogs will play ball with themselves, but they won't play it with you.
Yeah.
And there's a
difference.
They'll catch it, but they won't.
They won't bring it back. And Tristy would play with you. He didn't bother with playing by himself. And he wasn't very good at entertaining himself. But he would perform. And we taught him to fetch, and he loved that. And he would play that for hours. And then we decided, well, we'd teach him to catch. And we'd throw the ball up in the air, and he was real good at catching it. And then we'd applaud. And if we would applaud him, he would become a circus pony. And he would gallop round and round in a circle, just as big a circle as he could make. And sometimes if he was in the house, the doors open into one another so you can go through the rooms.
Yeah.
And he would just make a whole circuit of the house and come back into the living room.
Yeah.
Just circus pony all the way. And the more you'd applaud, the more excited he'd get. And just happy. Oh, he was happy. If he could make you think you were pleased with what he was doing and that he was entertaining you, that was it. And he would get cuddly, too. And he would love to just crawl up in your lap and go to sleep. He'd just feel like a baby. He just loved to be cuddled. Now, not many dogs do. And he was so tough. He was so hard. You couldn't touch him. I mean, you know, you could pet him, and you'd never feel that you were petting anything but a board.
Yeah.
But this thing that was just made out of wire springs and and metal. The most cuddly thing I think we've ever had. But he'd just go mad occasionally. And that's when you just couldn't, that was the tragic part of it. And when he did, you could never tell when it was going to be. Once he was in one of these fits, you couldn't get to him. You couldn't touch him. And you could hit him, and he wouldn't feel it. Wouldn't feel it at all. And you could shout at him, and he wouldn't hear you. And you could, if you were strong enough, you could pick him up and throw him across the room. And then he might come too, if he was gotten away from whatever he was after. And if he came too, he was fine. And he'd be all sweet and cuddly and ready to entertain. It was all over. But he wasn't after a person. But things like, my mother had a pair of furry bedroom slippers that she used to wear. And he would attack those when he saw them moving across the floor. Not always, just sometimes. If he was pretty excited and he suddenly saw them, he would attack them. And when he was a puppy, all he got was the shoes. But when he started going blind, he'd miss. And he'd get Mom's leg. She still got scars, I think, a couple of times where he got her. 'Cause he wasn't fooling. And Once he'd attacked those shoes, then you could do anything you wanted to, but you couldn't get him off. I mean, you could get him off. You could pick him up and carry him away. If you didn't mind him, he wouldn't necessarily bite at you. And that's just about all you could do. There was no good saying anything to him or hitting him or anything else. The only thing you could do was grab him, pick him up, and carry him away. And he got worse. This is the thing. He was terrible about people leaving. And he wouldn't go mad then. This was purely conscious. He just didn't want anybody to leave. And he would entertain you all night, but he wasn't going to let you go. And guests would come, and he would insist on being the center of attention and on entertaining, and he'd show them all his tricks and show them everything he could do. And they'd think, gee, what a nice dog, and then they'd start to leave. And let's see, I think it was about two or three pair of trousers we had to have rewoven.
Why, Barbara.
This is another thing. When he could see, all he would get was the trousers. But when he started going blind, he tended to miss occasionally.
Get the leg.
Very sad, really.
Yeah.
My grandmother, he was the only dog my grandmother liked.
Oh, really?
That was a record moment when we brought that puppy in.
Yeah.
And she picked him up and put him in her lap. Can you imagine my grandmother with a dog in her lap?
No.
No.
I've got the pictures to prove it. She fell in love with that puppy. And the only dog that she's ever liked, we had to have put to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And it broke her up.
Your mother said it did.
Yeah, it just broke her up. But he was her dog in much more than he was mine. To any four. But the reason he had to be put down is because she would have to bend down to do things, and he would attack you. He would attack your hair if you bent down. And Mom was scared to death that he was going to jump her, and she wouldn't be able to get up.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew that's why we had to have him put it down. I think that's why she was so upset.
Mm-hmm.
But he loved to just...
Well, most places like this would have a half a dozen dogs, a cat.
Yeah, that's one of the things I loved about the Tilts.
Yeah, that's nice.
They had five dogs and two cats and anything else that happened to be coming through.
Oh.
From leverets and baby rabbits to Jane's kitten that she brought back from the pet store. And there was Katie. And see, all of them had this tremendous personality. Every one of them was just this individual and really strong personality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just part of the way the place is. It was the sort of atmosphere where people noticed what sort of personality an animal had, you
mm-hmm.
know, and gave it a chance and deliberately developed it.
Mm-hmm.
Because old Katie, now, she was the owner. I mean, she had been there for 15, 16 years, ever since she was a young puppy. And it was her place. She was a nanny. And it was her place to raise anything new that came on the place, including children, dogs, puppies, I mean, kittens, anything that came on the place, right down to the newest leveret, was Katie's to take care of. And it was almost disastrous with Jane's kitten, because Jane's kitten was a tiny little thing that had been brought in with another litter to a pet store, and it was too young to be taken from its mother. It was from a different litter. So they gave it to Jane, and she was going to bottle raise it. And Katie thought she was its mother, that she should be allowed to mother it. And she would try to clean it. And she was so big, and the kitten was so tiny, that the kitten would disappear every time she'd try to lick it. And it would be precariously perched on top of a chair or on a wall or something like this. This little tiny thing just looked bone. It didn't look like it had anything else to it, just these little tiny bones with some skin over it. And Katie would come up and get ready to see it perched there, and she would give it a lick, and it would go tumbling off. Onto the floor or onto the chair and get lost. And Mrs. Tilt was rather fond of Jane's kitten because it reminded her so much of Debbie. Debbie was her cat. And Debbie was also a waif from a different litter. They had had another cat that kept having litters of kittens. And one day she brought in about four or five kittens. And Mrs. Tilt got rid of those kittens, or they grew. She kept them, but then all of a sudden, the old mama cat suddenly appeared with another kitten, a little tiny kitten that she wouldn't take care of. And I don't think it was hers. I think it was from another litter. So Mrs. Tilt adopted the little one and bottle fed it and brought it up. And a couple of times she nearly lost it and almost froze to death once. But she managed. She brought it up. And that kitten ruled the house of the cat when she was grown. She had a box in the kitchen. And she didn't, hers was not a forceful rule. It was merely her presence. Mm-hmm. And she had this box in the kitchen, and she would lie there all day. Never seemed to move. And at night, if there was somebody staying in the house upstairs, she would go up and sleep with them. But she wouldn't go outside the house, except when she had to. And when she did go out, she was very, very careful. Because obviously the outdoors was a dangerous and fearful world, inhabited by all sorts of creatures which were out to get her. And besides that, the outside belonged to Barnaby, the stable cat.
Oh.
Now, Barnaby never went up to the house, and Debbie never, never, never went down to the stable. Debbie would never be caught so far away from the house. Except when Mrs. Tilt went away on vacation. And when Mrs. Tilt would go away on vacation, anytime, Debbie would disappear. Nobody knows where she went. Nobody would see her. She'd just disappear. And the day that Mrs. Tilt arrived back, Debbie would be waiting for her at the steps to the door.
Barbara.
I'm not kidding. It's true. We didn't see her, we didn't see Debbie all the time that Mrs. Tilt was on vacation. And Judy said that it was like that every time she went on vacation. And then she would appear. The day that Mrs. Tilt came back, she would be waiting for her.
Yeah.
On the door.
Oh, shoot.
And she wouldn't be over glad to see her, but she would just say, sort of, well, you're back. I can get in my box now. And she would take her place in the kitchen again, and
yeah.
Everything was back to normal.
She was a queen?
She was queen. She wasn't not affectionate, but she didn't like to be handled, and she wouldn't come to be handled. She liked to have her face scratched a little, and she liked to be talked to, but she couldn't stand to be picked up and handled.
Most cats. Like to be picked up?
I don't know what it is. They vary. They're either definitely against or definitely for.
But some don't care.
Barnaby, now the stable cat, was an old tough. Well, he wasn't old. He was young, tough tomcat. And now he was affectionate. And he would just come in and make friends and crawl all over you and love to be picked up and handled, and he'd choose somebody that he would go to bed with every night and sleep at the foot of their bed. Or if they gave him a chance, he'd get down under the sheets and sleep at the foot of the bed that way. This is a stable cat. Our great hunter, our mouser.
Oh, he'd stay with you all down in the stable.
Yeah, down in the stable. He wouldn't go up to the house. House was Debbie's territory. And if you fed him just the right amount, he would hunt. You had to be careful not feeding too much. But if you fed him just the right amount, he'd hunt. And sometimes you wouldn't see him for 2 or 3 days, and then he'd come in and really beg for attention. And just say how sorry he was that he hadn't come in to see you. And I fed him for ages. Mrs. Parker, see, used to feed him. After Mrs. Parker left, I took him on. And I would give him his little bit of his food at night, and he'd eat it. And I'd be sitting in the club room watching TV, and all of a sudden this cat would be all over me. And after he had said thank you, he would go off someplace else and go to sleep. And every night, after he'd eaten, he would come in and say thank you. He never failed. And the only thing he didn't like was crowds of people, parties. That made him terribly nervous.
Yeah.
But just one or two new people he would come in and make friends with. And he liked, he was so funny about the kitten. Because at first he didn't know what it was and how to take it. And it was too tiny. It was too small to be real.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd never seen one. And he just sort of, you know, he'd run from it. He'd see it and he'd run. He could see he was scared of it. But after a while, he just, when it got bigger, he took it on. And he decided he was going to teach it the ways of a stable cat.
Oh, really?
And how to manage life in a stable.
Yeah.
And you would see this cat walking down the yard. And right behind it would be this miniature, I mean, little tiny thing, because it never got big. Never will, that kid. It'll always be just tiny. Little tiny thing walking right behind it and copying every move it made. And then it would get tired and it'd become a kitten again.
Hmm.
And sort of change the way it moved and everything. It'd become kind of rolly again. And Barnaby would turn around and look at it, as if to say, come on, young man, buck up. And he was teaching it to hunt. And I watched him one day, and they came down the yard, and Barnaby walking in his most professional manner. Just very, you know, the cat, where he puts his feet, and the tail up, just walking along, and the kitten right behind him, copying exactly. But Barnaby would flick his tail, just tip of it, back and forth. And the kitten would see it, and the kitten would jump it. And Barnaby would sit down and turn around and glare at him, and then he'd walk on, just say you didn't do it right. Well, the kitten got smart, and there was a stack of jumps, Cavaletti and poles, and the kitten was walking along behind, and tail flicked, he thought, I'll get him. So he went charging past Barnaby and spent 5 minutes climbing up those poles, and Barnaby just sat down and waited for him. Barnaby sat down about 3 or 4 feet in front of the Cavaletti, just, you know, one side of the Cavaletti, and sat there on the ground and watched him climb up the Cavaletti, watched him teeter out to the end of one pole that was further out than any of the others, and then Barnaby decided, I'll show him. And he just very carefully walked around the end of the Cavaletti, out of range of the kitten. And the kitten fumed. He just sat up there on the Cavaletti and fumed. And Barnaby walked on. that little tiny kitten just fuming.
Well, where were you?
I was standing in the yard. I don't know what I was doing. Watching. I think I was sitting in the sun doing nothing, the truth be told.
And this little thing took place.
Well, now, was that just to show that all the tilts and everybody kind of took in now and then?
Yeah. Oh, they all did. Every one of them could capture, when they were talking, the personality of an animal, even if they couldn't talk about something else. Now, Celia was not very good, you know, couldn't talk. I mean, she didn't talk very much. And when she did talk, it was mostly, you know, so chatter. But when she decided that she was going to talk about an animal, and an animal's reaction, a horse's reaction, or a dog's reaction to something, then she could talk. I mean, you could see that what was happening just as perfectly.
Hmm.
She wasn't bookish?
No, see, she wasn't bookish, no. Jane and see you. I never got very close to see you.
Yeah.
See you. But we couldn't get on the same wavelength.